Hello and welcome to this very special live episode of Shockwaves. It features myself, Robert Galuzzo, and my co-hosts Elric Kane and Rebecca McKendry. And what you're about to hear is the panel discussion that followed a screening of the 1988 rare Mexican-made horror film Don't Panic with our special guest from the American Genre Film Archive, or AGFA for short. You may remember they appeared way back on episode 61 of Shockwaves, so you might want to go back and revisit that chat. This was recorded live on Friday, July 12th at the Billy Wilder Theater at the Hammer Museum in Los Angeles. And this AGFA program was put together by the UCLA Film and Television Archive. We wanted to get this episode up as quickly as possible, as the screening series is now running for the rest of July and into most of August. And we wanted to give you, our listeners, a chance to attend. If you want to know more info about the screening series and where to get tickets, head over to cinema.ucla.edu. That's cinema.ucla.edu. And very special thanks to the lead programmer, KJ Relth, for hosting and inviting us down. And of course, to the incredible team from AGFA, who you're about to hear from momentarily. Enjoy. Welcome to this live episode of Shockwaves. I'm Rob Galuzzo. Sitting next to me is Rebecca McKendry.
Hello.
Elric Kane is in the can, I think, but we'll make note of that when he returns. And if you're unfamiliar, we're weekly. I'm sorry. I thought Ernie was waving at me.
Hi, Ernie. Ernie's here with us too, guys.
We are a weekly horror talk show podcast where we talk about wacky movies like this, new movies, interview people. And we've had AGFA on the show before, or at least we've had Joe on the show before.
And Brett.
And Brett's been on before. Brett's been on multiple iterations of our show, including Killer POV, the previous one. But for our listeners at home, if you guys wouldn't mind introducing yourselves and your role with AGFA, and then we'll delve into this wacky movie we just watched. Yeah. So
we'll start with Brett.
Okay. I'm Brett Berg. I'm head of theatrical sales for AGFA.
I'm Joe Ziemba. I'm the director of AGFA.
Alicia Coombs, head of business affairs.
Sebastian Del Castillo, head of film preservation.
And we have just viewed 1988's Don't Panic, which I tried to research the history of this film, and legit, there's like not much available online. So what can you guys tell us about the backstory of this one?
I think the first thing that people usually ask us is, where can I get some of those wild dino PJs?
How have you not merchandised that yet?
My 3-year-old has a pair. I don't know if like, and they totally look almost identical, but they're in like 3T. So
exactly.
Yeah, I don't know where I could get an adult pair. And you assume because he wore them through most of it, there's a lot of blood work. Like they had to have like quadruples of those jammies for this shoot. So yeah, I need to know where to get a pair.
Yeah, we don't know. We've tried like 2 decades. It's really, they don't exist. I don't know. Yeah.
Elric Kane has returned from the can.
Hello.
I'm sorry, baby. that's why I went to the bathroom so I could do that. No.
Elric and I have not seen this movie. How did you feel about it?
I thought it was more entertaining than a couple of the Nightmare on Street sequels and somehow less ludicrous than Soul Man. I don't know how that's possible, given that Soul Man is the most ludicrous of 80s comedy. But I actually think what I liked most about it, weirdly enough, is it might be the first film I've ever seen, like movies like Pieces, they're set in America, even though they're shot in Italy or wherever. Mm-hmm. And they go, you know, they put American flags everywhere they can. I love that this one just leads with, oh, I'm going to Mexico now. And then everything is an American trope after that fact. And so it's like, it's kind of perplexing, but I kind of love that about it. It was like a really weird line in culture mix, I thought. So I don't think I've seen that enough, especially not in a slasher film before. Mm-hmm. So it was cool.
Yeah, I mean, I think that runs through a lot of Mexican genre cinema because I think that they always start in a place where Western culture is influencing them, and they see something that's big across the world. Like, what is the big thing that's happening, and how can we make it for our own? You know, that goes back to, like, you know, the creature from the Black Lagoon in Mexico was a red creature, and instead of having protagonists like a scientist, the protagonist was Batwoman in the Creature from the Black Lagoon movie, in the Mexican one. And like, there's a child's play version of Child's Play from Mexico called Herencia Diabolica, where instead of instead of Chucky, there's a little person clown who actually looks like a 500-year-old, like, Buster Keaton in clown drag. So
I must always see this.
Yes, adding different permutations from reality on top of these movies. And this one's no different. And this one's kind of like one of the best Nightmare Freddy movies, which is like, you know, Freddy ripoffs in that way, in terms of what it's bringing to it.
Well, so, I love that it's like, it's a nightmare ripoff in concept, but like nothing like it at all. Like the idea, it's like a possessed serial. Well, don't play with Ouija boards. That's mm-hmm. the lesson in every horror movie. But can you tell us how, so tell us if you can, in terms of how AGFA works, how do you find something like this and bring it to a place like this tonight? How does that happen? Where did you guys first discover this movie?
Yeah.
I don't know where this movie came from. It's been in the archive since I've been around.
Right. So Sebastian's like the leader of the archive. He's been around more than any of us at AGFA. So I figured you'd know, but nope.
I don't.
We don't know.
I don't know.
Yeah.
I wish I did.
Yeah. I mean, we have one of the only prints in the world for sure.
That's true.
You know.
Well, back then, Tim League and company would regularly just buy depots that would go out of business, like take hundreds of prints at a time and sort it out later. And this, I'm presuming, was just in with the mix of stuff.
Yeah. I mean, this is what you want to find in the archive. Like, these are the movies that we want, you know, and they're like, yeah.
What do you guys know about the filmmaker? Like, I noticed he'd done a couple of other titles before this one. Does he have any history that you can talk about?
Yeah, there's a really rich history of the Ruben Galindo and his father, Ruben Galindo Sr. They were huge movers and shakers in Mexican genre history, and there was a couple of different families. The Cardonas was another one. Mm-hmm. So there's a long line of movie making in the history of their families, and you'll see when they're watching the TV in this movie. It's a movie called Cemetery of Terror, which is another one of his movies. But I don't know much about their family other than they were awesome, clearly, you know, and what they did. But yeah, they were very prolific, made a lot of movies. But we did track down John Michael Bischoff, who is Michael in the movie. He lives in San Antonio now. And I emailed a little bit with him. And he also sings the song, Don't Panic, which is incredible. It's going to be in your head for the rest of the year. Thank God. And so he's really cool and really nice. And, you know, we reached out to him. We're like, we have this print of Don't Panic. Do you know anything about? And he knew nothing. He's just like, oh my gosh, I can't believe you want to know about that. And I really wanted to know the lyrics to the Don't Panic song, cause I can't make them out, but he gave me the lyrics to the song. And, you know, he was super nice, but he also did not know where those dinosaur pajamas went. So, you know,
they didn't let him keep a pair. I said they didn't let him keep a pair, like wear them always.
You would think that they would, but, you know.
Did he offer any insight as to why the filmmakers deliberately chose the pajamas as like a movie-making choice?
You know, he wasn't really forthcoming with information about those pajamas, so I don't know. I just asked him if he still had them. So
it actually creates a really strange, for me, this will sound ridiculous, but it did create a weird tension in the film that it goes from like his love scene to his mother holding him in pajamas, keeps calling him baby and stroking his face. And there's this really weird stunted adolescence thing that runs throughout this film that is actually the creepiest element of the film. This kind of incestual, you know, because I don't know if she has a drinking problem.
No, it was
apparently.
Totally. So it's like, you know,
who knew?
No, but there was this scene where he kept going, I'm scared, Mom, I'm scared. And he was like right in her face, like to an uncomfortable
almost
point.
Burial ground weird, like, you know, dwarf kid thing. Yeah,
I love that you said that.
Burial ground humor. There's a select audience for that.
We're here with them.
I also like the idea that when you're on the phone to him in San Antonio, that he's saying, I have no idea where the pajamas go, and he's just like wearing the pajamas. Like, he's just like a grown man sitting there going, I don't know where they went.
One of the things that I found most interesting when we were watching the credits is Screaming Mad George did the effects in this. And this would have been like post-Society, right? Like,
right around.
Yeah, because if Society, this is 88 and Society is like just a year or so before that.
Yeah.
Is that right? 89.
Yeah,
oh, so Bride, after this. Okay, yeah. So, but right. I really want to know how he got involved in this. So we now have to track him down and ask him.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think anyone's ever asked him about Don't Panic. So that would be great to hear.
Yeah. And it does have some decent effects in it. Like there's a couple moments where you know, it's good. So.
Like the levitating roses. Yeah. Good moment. It's quite beautiful.
We knew that would come back into play.
Yeah.
How can people see this? Is this only exist as a print? Is there, because AGFA has put out some physical releases of their stuff. So can you tell us a little bit about how more people can see this crazy little movie?
I've been talking a bunch, so I want to hand the mic over.
Well, pretty much just theatrically at this point. I would say this print, we did preserve it at one point, but I don't know if that'll ever, you know, get around. But this print is definitely around.
Yeah, you can book this print from us. I mean, we know who owns the movie. We're working on it. We're trying to make it happen so that more people can see this outside of the theatrical print, but time will tell. We'll see.
Did it do business at the time? Because, I mean, I'm assuming on the zeitgeist of where it was in the nightmare flow, it must have done business. But did it do business here in the States?
I would imagine that it did because they struck prints, you know, and dubbed it into English. But gosh, who knows? You know, I mean, yeah, I would like to think that it did better than all of the Nightmare on Elm Street movies combined because it deserves it. But I don't think so.
It is a really fascinating time capsule of the 1980s. And anytime that you can find something that kind of preserves it and kind of the campiness of the wardrobe so well, it's always a gem. So it's wonderful to see this.
And it's also a family melodrama masquerading as a genre film. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like A Quiet Place or Us in that way.
Or Nightmare on Elm Street, one and two. I think both of them have, you get the Clue Gulager psychodrama in number two a little bit, so it's got a bit of that. Well, should we segue into actual other AGFA stuff that you guys are doing here, especially with the series? Because, I mean, this movie, I feel bad for anyone who's not here and didn't get to experience that if they're listening. But in terms of what you guys do, well, I know you've told this audience a little bit about AGFA, and we've had you on the show before, but this series specifically, you guys are kind of going through very different subgenres. And something I love about movies and what I think I respond to most about what you guys do is that it's almost, it's kind of like the Danny Perry books. It's equal, you know, Citizen Kane's in black and white right next to, you know, Ed Wood right next to anything. And I don't think you guys, to me, don't feel like you have any filter in terms of what you're interested in, what you're passionate about. So maybe just speak to that a bit about this particular program, because I think this is a pretty nice diverse cross section of it.
Yeah. The 10 years of AGFA have really been a journey. You know, for a long time, there was no AGFA team. The only person caring for and managing these prints was Sebastian for years. There was a long process of having to discover what those prints were, like in the case of Don't Panic. If anyone in the audience can join us tomorrow for our Reel One party, we can get into that process more because that's a really what it's all about. But then, you know, from that point, being able to get into digital preservation, being able to get into home video, and to be able to distribute for our label partners, because now we do theatrical distribution for labels like Arrow, Severin, Shout Factory, Vinegar Syndrome, and others. So this program really is a sampling of all of that. From the deep cut prints that are really only available that way to our preservations and our label, some of the label titles that we're really excited about.
Does it sometimes create problems when you, obviously, if you discover something in a vault or a lab that's closed and you have no idea what the chain of title is? I mean, one of the most incredible experiences I've had in the last few years in a movie theater was just before CineFamily closed with The Astrologer, was just like, you're speechless, even though I spoke a lot afterwards. But it was really remarkable. And I just remember hearing how that was found, but also going like, how would you then find out who has the rights to that film? Obviously, if you can't find the auteur behind it, it'd be really tricky. But I imagine that must come up a lot in that scenario.
You wait for someone to send you a cease and desist.
Oh, really? That's it? Just keep playing it?
I picture an Indiana Jones-esque search where it involves good hats and like a lot of running from things. So,
and this guy.
Yeah, and this guy. So, yeah, do you have to do a lot of, like, rights hunting? And is it, like, trails of paperwork that you have to follow along with?
Well, when it comes to the prints, you know, our prints are provided separate from rights. You know, it's up to, when someone books a print, it's up to them to find the rights. You know, we just hold these materials. Certainly for anything that we want to do anything with beyond that, something like a home video release, of course, we're doing our due diligence. And anytime, you know, this one's a mystery. Sometimes if one becomes not a mystery, sometimes we don't screen that one anymore. And it's sad, but it means we, you know, we can't do it. We definitely do our due diligence. There was a Wild West period, but those days are over.
Yeah, I mean, it takes a lot of detective work overall. I mean, we all program too for the Alamo. So it's like kind of comes with the territory where you have to, you kind of figure out a way working with other programmers how to track down prints and different avenues you can go down. And you just kind of get good at it over a period of time. But it's really detective work when it comes to rights.
I'm curious, was there a particular find that was, I mean, I don't even know if the story I read was true about the astrologer, that somebody found it and it had the title, but they thought it was a different movie that was made around the same time with that title and almost discarded or something?
With that movie in particular?
Yeah.
There were two movies, I think the same year, maybe? Same year that came out, both called The Astrologer.
Uh-huh.
We should set the record straight in The Astrologer once for all. Maybe anyone's listening. Like,
I was thinking about this too while I was sitting there.
Let's talk about this. Yeah, we get requests all the time for this movie and it's played theatrically a lot. So this movie is owned by an entity that will never let it go. We will never be able to release The Astrologer, and it's not because of music rights. It's because it's owned by a major studio. So like ACFA's not going to be putting out The Astrologer. We love the movie. We would love to do it, but it's just not going to happen because we don't have lots of money. So that's basically where it's at. It's as transparent as possible. Yeah. You know, that's where that movie's at.
Yeah, we would love to book it. Trust us.
Yeah.
That's actually really interesting. I'm really surprised the giant entity owns that movie.
You find out when you get a cease and desist.
Right.
You know, that's how it happens. Yeah.
But walk us through some more from this program, because I know there's some things close to Becca's heart in this program.
Excuse me. Doris Wishman.
Doris Wishman.
Yeah.
We have some Lady Terminator. Just a lot of, some of the stuff that we're
Suburbia.
Probably more. Yeah, Suburbia.
Suburbia.
What we're familiar with, but maybe starting with The Real One Party, because I think a lot of people might not have a clue what that was when you're referencing it.
Sure. Well, you know, the history of The Real One Party was that, you know, there were so many prints that we didn't know what they were. So we started setting up these events where we would play the first reel of five prints. What the heck is this, you know? And then once we play that first night with an audience, you know, there's always going to be at least one gem, one that you have to see the whole thing. So then there's usually a second event that shows the whole movie. So that was really one of the best ways, one of the most fun ways to discover everything that was in the archive. Of course, that process is really over. We have everything. We know what they are. It's all cataloged. So now that we're getting to do a Real One Party here, now it's all of our favorites. So this is the only Real One Party that's been curated specifically to be like the most fun, wacky sampling of the prints that are dear to our hearts.
Yeah. Maximum impact.
Yeah. As Brett always says, guaranteed to rip your head off.
Part of you is going to go on the floor somewhere.
You brought up Doris Wishman, and we got to talk about Doris Wishman because we are probably the biggest Doris Wishman like fanatics on earth at this point. And we love Doris Wishman so much. And the fact now that we get to work with her films, which I don't know if we've really talked about yet publicly very much. We've had a couple screenings, but
Rarely comes up on the show because it's not necessarily horror. And even though I wedge her into conversations a lot, like we never get to dive into Doris. And I love her so much.
And if you need horror, she's got A Night to Dismember and Indecent Desires is a little bit of horror in it. So Doris Wishman she's my favorite filmmaker of all time. She's my favorite director. And it just kind of chanced upon that now we are actually restoring all of her films starting from the beginning. We're really, really excited about that. And we started with Nude on the Moon, which had a restoration at MoMA recently, which was as mind-blowing as this is right now to be on the stage to us. So Doris is very near and true to our hearts, and it means a lot. It's like a dream come true.
Did that come, because something that was always dear to me was Something Weird Video, was just one of those things that I would go to and be surprised. I remember we were talking about Psyched by the 4D Witch off air, seeing that on screen for the first time. It's just these pieces of movies that feel completely forgotten, but still have moments of just brilliance. But was the relationship after, you know, Mike Rainey's passing. Was this part of how Doris Wishman's work came to you?
Yeah, it was definitely a connection. After Mike Vraney, who was the founder of Something Weird Video, passed away in 2014. And Lisa Petrucci, who is his partner and creative partner, she's chosen to carry on the torch of Something Weird and keep the legacy going. And those of you that don't know Something Weird, look them up, find their movies, support them, because if it wasn't for Something Weird, I don't know if we'd be here, really. They were like our film education, a big part of why we love what we do, and taught us to recontextualize and see movies in a different way.
And they have an amazing VOD channel now.
Yeah.
It's really good.
Yeah.
A lot of great titles on it.
And so, you know, Mike had passed away and we reached out to Lisa and started talking with her about, you know, what her plans were. And it just so ended up that she was interested in working with us. So we did a Kickstarter to get our 4K scanner. And that was successful. And then we started working on restorations from the Something Weird archive. And so Doris Wishman came out of that. Something Weird didn't actually own the rights to Doris Wishman. That was a third party. But the same party that owned the Herschel Gordon Lewis movies, we found out owned the Doris Wishman movies. So we started doing theatrical on Herschel Gordon Lewis's catalog. And then after that, the rights holder said, oh, I have Doris Wishman's catalog too. And we were like, ah, like, oh my God, what? And so, yeah, we jumped at the chance to work with them. Yeah.
There's a great interview for people just curious after hearing you talk about Doris Wishman on the Incredibly Strange Film Show.
Yeah.
With Jonathan Ross back in the day. And that was how I had never heard of her. But, you know, 20 years ago when I came across all those on VHS, I remember being kind of just blown away by this, you know, elderly woman living in Florida. Where was she working at the end? Was it
a sex shop? Right?
And she's like, there's just something about her spirit that was just, you know, remarkable.
Yeah, there's a transcription of it in the Incredibly Strange book as well, which you can pick up for pennies on Amazon now.
But yeah, so walk us through some of the others, because I remember back in the day screening Lady Terminator, and it went over gangbusters at a screening. So I've never seen Sister Street Fighter that it's paired with, but maybe talk a little bit about how, because I didn't realize Lady Terminator part of your collective, it was part of the AGFA, or? Okay.
Yeah, the print is.
Okay. Oh, the print, okay.
Sister Street Fighter is a title that came to us from Arrow Video, and it's one of the many restorations that they totally kill it with. I don't know if you ever look at their Blu-rays, but they're some of the best in the world in terms of preserving genre film. Sister Street Fighter was new to me. You knew it, but I didn't actually know it. And it's a companion piece to Sonny Chiba's Street Fighter series. And, you know, it's self-explanatory. Sister Street Fighter is awesome. And who's the actress?
Su Shiomi.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the cool thing is that, like, Sister Street Fighter is something that you know is out there and you can get, like, you know, badly dubbed DVDs or whatever, but it's never been available theatrically. And that's what's really important to us, is that, like, the theatrical experience is so important to AGFA and so, like, what we do. So the fact that now there's this gorgeous, stunning, beautiful restoration of Sister Street Fighter that is available to book is, like, a revelation to us. And, like, that's, like, the key thing where it's like, oh, man, like, seeing this with a crowd, it just means so much.
I am so excited about this one because it's one of the few, like, nunsploitation films that I have not seen, which is, like, another one of my major loves. And I have somehow missed this one. And so I'm super excited to dive into Sister Street Fighter. It's going to be fun.
In the commercial, the UCLA commercial that came up at the start about the archive, the one part that I'm always kind of fascinated, and I guess this maybe starts with you, it talks about the cost of preservation. Mm-hmm. And what are some of those, what are some of the processes that you're going through? I mean, I don't want to be too dry, but I'm just curious why it's so expensive, so people can maybe understand that, like, sometimes when we see this great looking vinegar syndrome that we just take for granted, right? This disc of an obscure movie, there's been so much work put into that and maybe cost, so people understand why it's worth buying these things, you know, when they're first coming out.
Well, yeah, I mean, the scanner costs a lot of money. Mm. And the labor costs a lot of money too. Mm.
And I assume it's a fairly long process in cleaning up. I mean, I guess it depends on the erosion of a print or...
Yeah, it depends on the print, but, or the negative, but I'd say like at least a week.
Mm. Okay, per time. Depending on what it looks like. Because when they have the before and after, if we see the, say, the pink vinegar syndrome, what can be done to that? I guess that's what I'm saying. If you get something at that stage, is it too late to restore something? Or?
Well, it depends. It can be. Mm.
Okay. It's all about the shrinkage. Mm. Film, when it decomposes, can shrink like 1% to 2%. And that's just enough to not register with the sprockets anymore.
Right. Got it. Okay. Interesting.
And speaking of vinegar syndrome, I think it's like, it's good to say that, like, right now, because of labels like Vinegar Syndrome and Severin and Arrow and Shout Factory doing all this work, like, we're in a golden age of not only exhibition, but just availability of these movies. And we should never take it for granted because we've worked so hard for years. You could only see like grainy VHS copies of these movies. And now there's all these beautiful restorations coming out like quicker than we can keep up with. But like go out there and explore these movies and buy them and have fun and enjoy. That's what it's all about. They're there to make us happy. And like, we're in like such an amazing age for that stuff now. And like, we're so happy to be just like a tiny small part of that at AGFA. It's really inspiring.
Yeah. These restorations are like time machines. You really can reach out and almost feel that past because of the way that you can just focus in on the grain and stuff. And I don't know. Yeah. Like he said, go out and see more movies. But I think, oh, you know that already.
Well, I mean, and Rob's, you know, the biggest proponent of physical media collecting. But like often, I don't always watch the stuff I collect, but it's like the fact that you know it's there, there's nothing to me worse than seeing, oh, something was on Amazon Prime one day and I'll get to that. Then you go back and it's gone forever. Mm-hmm. And these things, that's happening all the time. It's such an unreliable medium when we're talking about streaming. Mm-hmm. You know, it's exciting and it's not a negative by any means, but it's, I think there's just such a still something so valuable about physical media. I assume that's why you collect everything. You have every
it's
movie.
It's out of control at this point. But no, I mean, it's I prefer
a room, right?
I prefer
it's
seeing,
a room.
It's an apartment full of physical media at this point. But no, I mean, this is the two best ways to watch a movie, obviously, are theatrical with an audience. And at home, like, I've never had a flawless streaming experience. Like, there's always something. The subtitles will be off. It'll go, you know, blurry for a sec, whatever it is. But that never happens when you invite friends over and pop over a Blu-ray and see films like this restored and probably better than they've ever looked before. So yeah, it's important to me to collect stuff physically too. I mean, again, Vinegar Syndrome puts out whatever it is, 4, 5, 6 titles a month. And it is Russian roulette, I call it. It's not even a gamble. Right, it is Russian roulette. Like,
I watched Nightmare
what is
Weekend
this
last weekend.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. That was, I don't even know what, there was a puppet. It was
a puppet.
It was chaos. There was a computer. It was chaos.
I got to see Runaway Nightmare this year. And
yes. Mike Cartel's Runaway Nightmare.
The person I watched it with was done in like 30 minutes and we stopped it and put something else on. I said, can we come back to that? We put it back on. And by the end of it, I was like, this is amazing. Like, it's just one of those films that won you over time.
I hope that.
I mean, last year, I think our film of the year was The Devil's Honey, which was a Severin title. And that one, none of us had heard of it.
Fulci like we've never seen before.
It was full Fulci. It was full of a lot of things. But yeah, that was definitely like one of our best finds of the year. And that was a Severin one that we had never even heard of. And we thought we had seen all Fulci. So
it's Fulci doing Red Shoe Diaries.
Yeah.
It is. It is.
With a subtle saxophone scene at the start.
Subtle.
Very subtle. But the Runaway Train, I hate because it gets used so much. People say things are Lynchian. But there's moments in Runaway Nightmare where some of the dialogue and some of the characters look like some of the extras in Blue Velvet. And the way they deliver dialogue, it's so stilted. It doesn't seem purposely Lynchy. It feels like this guy, they're different universes. And yet it has some quality that's coming out of that just, I don't know, I think if you're an explorer of movies, and you guys certainly, you know, without a doubt are, and that's part of your job is to uncover this stuff. But I feel like as audience members being on the hunt for that discovery, these labels are all providing that. And the idea, you might say a couple things that bore you or are not your bag, but you will also find something like I just was telling you off air, The Child in the new Arrow box set for me just a couple days ago after seeing a couple in the first box set, none of them really spoke to me. And I saw that film and halfway through, I was like, this might be the find of the year, you know? It has something magical and unplanned about it, you know?
I love the various labels, you know, focus on different niches. You know, Vinegar Syndrome has a couple of my favorite like home video horror titles, like Dear Dead Delilah and Dominique are two of my favorites. It's like a certain area that they get into that I don't see from the other labels. That's really exciting. Dear Dead Delilah is like a summer stock doing Tennessee Williams with Agnes Moorehead, but it's also a horror movie. And
that sounds like my jam.
Yeah,
it's great. And Dominique is like Diabolique, but not.
But Dominique.
But yeah, fitting into that like quiet sort of regional. It's like a very specific niche that I love finding those niches within label offerings. And I guess we've been kind of trying to figure out what our niche is too. And we kind of feel like it's sort of an outsider feel, even though we deal in different, you know, we don't have like a the option to focus on a particular genre or, you know, anything really specific, but everything we're drawn to and everything we hunt after has this outsider feel.
Yeah, we had a conversation in the office about it recently. We're like, oh, this is what we do. It's outsider filmmaking. That's the stuff we gravitate towards. And I think on Sarah Jacobson's films, which are playing later as part of this series, like I think that was the one that kind of like solidified it for us. We're like, oh, that's what we do, her movies.
I'm familiar with those ones, and I know TCM Underground recently did it, which was super cool. But the film you're playing after those two, which is like a 40-minute film by the actress who was in Helen Lauder films and a whole bunch of stuff, I had never heard of that. And I saw it on the posted on the site. Can you explain a little more?
Oh, of course. Yeah, so the movie you're talking about is Limbo from 1999. It's written and directed by a woman named Tina Kraus, who was most well-known for starring in hundreds of movies by this company called Wave Productions in the 90s. And Wave Productions was a mail-order movie company, like Song Poems, which is like people would go to their house and write down scripts and send it to Wave and pay them $1,000, and then they would make their movies on camcorders. And as you can imagine, it's incredible because like I want to read the autobiographies of these people for every one of these Wave movies because they get out there and they get strange. So Tina Kraus was an actor in all of these movies. She appears in hundreds of Wave movies, and I had no idea that she had actually written and directed her own shot on video horror movie. And you would think that you know, going into this movie, it would be something similar to a Wave Productions movie. It's just like a zombie movie, or it's a Dracula movie where Dracula drowns in quicksand, because that seems to happen in every Wave movie. I don't know why. There's just a quicksand thing going on.
Great trope.
But Limbo is actually something more than that. I mean, not only was it the, one of the only shot into your horror movies made by a woman, but it is a very, as you'd said, Lynchian in a way. It's a kind of, it's like David Lynch and Nine Inch Nails getting together to make a shot on video horror movie. And it's exactly like that. So it's
a Lost Highway.
Yeah, it's Lost Highway. It's Tina Kraus' Lost Highway. But it's really unique, and it's really well done, and it's serious. A lot, like during the 90s, people were like getting ironic, and they were like meta, and they're going the comedy route, and this is like dead serious. It's very personal to her, and she just made this one movie, and discovering that was really special to me because that's like exactly what I'm drawn to.
So when you approach her, is she just like, what? Like that you want to show this? Is it like, or is it actually really touching to somebody that you're uncovering this and like bringing it to an audience?
Yeah, it's actually both. And I mean, how it happened is I'm part of Bleeding Skull with my partner Annie Choi, who's here tonight, and our friend Zach Carlson. And how that happened, that whole thing is we're working on another book that's coming out with Fantagraphics in 2020. It's called Bleeding Skull, a 1990s Trash Horror Odyssey. And so
pre-order
Limbo.
Pre-order it now.
Thanks.
Limbo pre-ordered is, mine.
Thank you. Limbo is one of the movies that I had watched for the second book, and when I it was one of my favorites, one of my top 10 favorites of the book. And you know, we were just like, where is this movie, like what's going on? And we found out that Tina had lived in Brooklyn and Annie lives in New York, so we thought, let's reach out to Tina Kraus and try to get some stills from the movie for the book. And we did that, and then Annie ended up being like a hero in meeting up with her and like, you know, talking and hanging out and getting drinks and stuff. And then finally I was like, do you want to ask her about Limbo? Maybe she wants to do something with it. And so Annie asked her like, hey, do you want to work with Agfa and Bleeding Skull to release Limbo? And I think she flipped out. I think she was super excited. I think she called her dad and was like, do you remember that movie I made 30 years ago? Well, it's finally going to come out. It's really fulfilling when that happens, because you don't know how people are going to react. You know, they made this movie 30 years ago. Maybe it's something that's painful for them. Maybe it was something that they'd forgotten about. But with her, I think she was just stoked. She was so happy, because I think when she originally tried to get the movie out there, she would submit it to film festivals and they would reject her. And then she would submit it under a man's name and they would accept her. Yeah. So at one of these screenings, she actually submitted it and she got accepted and she won the award, like the best new movie at the screening. And she went up there and she was like, fuck you. I'm Tina Kraus, not Michael Kraus. It's a great story, you know, and the movie deserves to be out there. It's important to shot on video horror history. It's important for humankind in general that this movie be out there. So.
And will it get out there beyond the screening?
Yeah.
Okay, cool.
So yeah, it's coming out next February with Agfa and Bleeding Skull. So we're releasing it. It'll be on Blu-ray and DVD.
Yeah.
Well, we've had a long-running in-joke between us about the connoisseurship of SOV cinema. I like to call it the Grey Pouponing of SOV.
we talk about this a fair amount on the show as well.
Yeah.
It comes up.
And we realize that the best through line, just marketing-wise, for certain titles like Limbo or any of the other SOV titles that we put out is just our enthusiasm for them. Mm-hmm. That tends to bleed through easily. So we've led with that. But we've long talked about how to isolate like the finest moments in SOV cinema and give them a platform, and Limbo's in that tradition.
And well, Limbo's a special one too, because when you watch it, you know exactly what it would look like if she had the money she needed, you know, which that's a great thing to see. I mean, that's all her. That's all the talent that's behind it. So, you know, sometimes you don't necessarily see that with shot on video, but the good ones, you know, you see the passion behind it and you see the vision. Like, they don't have the money, but you see the vision completely.
Are there any SOV gems? I mean, I know Severin, well, Intervision originally put out, you know, Sledgehammer and a couple of other films at that time.
Things.
Are there other,
Things.
Well, Things is actually Super 8 a lot.
Super 8.
Oh.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's still in that thing.
Yeah, it
you
feels
know?
Part
Jeez,
of the
guys,
grouping.
Super 8. no, but it, yeah, Things has the spirit of
Nail
that
gun.
Homemade film.
Is no
Nail Gun Massacre, I'm not sure.
No. Which one?
Nail Gun Massacre?
Is not.
No, that's
There's
film,
one
right?
of the Massacre films. No.
Oh, Woodchipper Massacre is...
Oh, that's
That's the one.
Video. Yeah, Shutter.
That is not one of the gems I'm talking about. But are there other... other
fun!
Oh, man. It's like Family Ties gone wrong. It's kind of...
exactly.
It's fun.
But are there gems out there that you guys would... You know, I don't know if you can talk about things you have your eye on or that you would love to get, but are there just things that you think deserve to cross over to, you know, to audiences that maybe have the stigma of being SOV?
Yeah, absolutely. There are lots of those. I think that the great thing about, you know, the labels rediscovering this movie is, like you'd mentioned, Intervision doing Sledgehammer and Things. I mean, they were the first ones to actually put these out on DVD and make them available. And I think the good thing about it is that it's, reconfiguring the way that people look at these movies. You know, I think that there used to be a big stigma with shot on video horror, and you were not cool if you loved Boarding House at one point in time. And you couldn't talk about it, you know, because people would look at you like, there's something wrong with you. I'm a huge fan of Boarding House. I love it. It's one of my favorite movies. And your coworkers would be like, ah, like, I don't know. That's like scary. Maybe you shouldn't talk about that at work. But
I love your coworkers that they knew Boarding House. That's cool. even to reject you, that's
they
cool.
did not, but I showed them a little bit of it anyway. I got fired, by the way.
Oh, what?
Anyway, so what I mean to say is that there's a shift in culture. People are looking at these movies differently because of the way that they're being reissued in the world and presented to people in a new way, and it's with respect. And like, that's the key. And I think that's what's really important. I mean, we're always going to be battling against So Bad It's Good, always. Like, we hate that. Like, every day we wage war against that because it's not kind to the filmmakers. And it's a very entitled type of thinking, like saying that, like, you can laugh at this movie because it's not up to your standards. It's like, come on, get the fuck out of here. Like, there's no place for that anymore. So I think the important thing is that these movies are being put out there and being allowed to breathe and being allowed to be seen in a new way, which is super important. But to answer your question, yes, there's a lot out there that we are excited about. You know, coming up with Agfa and Bleeding Skull, you mentioned Things. Barry J. Gillis, who is one of the geniuses behind Things, made a movie called Wicked World in 1991 as a follow-up to Things that never was really released, and we are releasing that movie in November.
Barry.
Features yes, we have a Barry J. Gillis fan in the house. Thank you,
and,
sir.
And I think Barry's here too, right? Maybe? No.
It features a novel editing style you will enjoy.
Oh.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mustache or no mustache? Is he in it?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
He plays a loose cannon cop on the trail of a serial killer who killed his girlfriend.
Oh, wow.
Yes, okay. He is. But yeah, there's a lot of stuff on the way. And like, one that I'm particularly excited about is, there's this guy from Chicago named David the Rock Nelson, who is a, tireless champion of making, you know, werewolf and Frankenstein movies in his backyard that feel, and I mean this as a compliment, feel as if a 10-year-old picked up a camcorder, but he's like 50.
He calls himself the modern day Ed Wood, and he owns it. Like, he emblazons it on his Facebook page. Like, that is his claim to fame. And so, yeah, like it has an aesthetic in it though.
Yeah,
like, there's something
pure.
To it.
That guy's pure. He's the purest as it comes. So we finally, after like months of talking, we were able to work with him to finally start releasing his movies, I think in 2021, which is really, really exciting for me because being from Chicago and kind of growing up and maturing with his movies and finding them in the mid-90s and now actually being able to, for the first time ever, bring them to a new audience is really special and insane that it's happening.
To get excited in advance, I advise you to all follow him on YouTube.
It's amazing. Yeah. His YouTube channel is fun.
A never-ending stream of content.
Dunk it for the mummy, man. Gotta dunk my donut and eat my coffee in Java, man.
It's a little preview.
A taste.
Yeah.
Any other key titles from this particular series that we're missing? I know it ends with Suburbia. Is that right?
The series.
The series here?
Yeah, Suburbia and Rock and Roll High School.
Okay, yeah. Nice. But am I missing any of the key events? I just want to make sure that they're all highlighted. Because
well, also the Miskatonic offsite.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we got to talk about that. And Lisa Petrucci and Something Weird. These are kind of go together.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So we're showing Nude on the Moon, the Doris Wishman restoration that we were talking about, which has been a fantastic bridge for AGFA to the rest of the world. Because not only did the restoration of this movie premiere at MoMA, it's also playing here at the Hammer and has played at the BFI and also played at Cineteca Madrid on July 4th. So Doris's work is getting out there and she's going to have a following whether she wants it or not. She's going to have it.
And so what is the Miskatonic? I know Kayla was here earlier. What is the topic of the Miskatonic conversation exactly? Cause I saw Roberta Findlay's name also mentioned.
Yeah. So Lisa Petrucci of Something Weird Video is going to come down here from Seattle and she's going to give a whole 2-hour plus presentation on the work of Doris Wishman and Roberta Findlay, two of the only female exploitation filmmakers of that era.
Yeah, and these lectures are all horror-based lectures that are held at the UPRS, which is the University of Philosophical Research Studies, mm-hmm. which is a really just one of those spaces that if you haven't been yet, find an excuse to go because it's like this little gem in LA. It's definitely a hidden spot.
Ask to tour the library.
Yeah.
It's so Lovecraftian.
It really does look like P. Manley Hall set up, and he actually is the person who married Bela Lugosi, and so there's photos. I mean, he didn't marry Bela Lugosi, but he held the ceremony there. Yeah. It would have been interesting, but no. So it's got this rich history. But you go. This is the thing about LA. There's something I sometimes really dislike when everything's so new and dirty, and then sometimes you'll turn a corner and there's something perfectly preserved from a different era that to me is just has this utterly rich history to it, and mm-hmm. it's kind of like what you guys do. And so I remember when we kind of connected that to Miskatonic, I thought those two things were a perfect fit.
Yeah, I'd driven past that building half a dozen times, and it wasn't until we did the tour that I was like, oh my gosh, it's brilliant.
So this sounds like a good
go
excuse.
To Miskatonic yeah. and ask to tour the library. It's wonderful.
Oh, one other thing that we forgot that's in the series. So also on the bill with Nude on the Moon is Smut Without Smut, right? So Smut Without Smut is a new, I guess we'll call it an anthology series that that Joe cuts together from Vinegar Syndrome's archive of XXX movies. So we've been trying to find uses theatrically for vintage adult film, and it's kind of tricky in today's market. So this is one way to actually get that to preserve the work in a way.
Yeah, because I'm so obsessed with horror movies that I got to see everything and all the DIY stuff. I want to see more of it. And in the adult world, there are all these like hour long horror movies that are just fascinating to me because they are as low budget as it gets. I mean, they are just like the lowest of low. And but they also happen to be adult movies. So it's like not everybody wants to watch that. So how can we like watch these things? So the idea we had is to take these adult movies and cut out all of the sex scenes and then present them as just straight horror movies. And what is that like? And it's amazing. it's so great. So wow. We did three as kind of warm-ups with Something Weird and Vinegar Syndrome at Alamo shows, and we just screened them. And then the one that we have now that's available theatrically is called Smut Without Smut, Bizarro Horror Night. And that's like the one. That's like the best of the best. And so, yeah, we cut that together, and it's so much fun to watch because you're never going to see this stuff. I mean, normies, like people that are like civilians, like are not going to go seek out, Dr. Sexual and Mr. Hyde. They're just not going to do it. So it's a way for people to see these things without feeling bad or like, feel like, it's like just have fun and watch it, So, yeah.
And it's playing with Nude on the Moon because one of the features included is Doris Wishman's Haunted Pussy, a.k.a. Nice. Come With Me, My Love.
Mm-hmm. Where does the smut go that you edit out?
You don't want to
know. A whole different reel.
Is that the extra features? It's just the smut in a row for the... We got to screen that. If we can screen that at the UCLA archive, oh man.
Well, it's like 5.5 hours long because the movies are 60 minutes and you cut out all the sex and they're like 17 minutes.
Wow.
So it's a very long reel.
Is there a particular one that is just as a film you were actually like, this is actually a really great film?
You know, there's a couple. There's one called Widow Blue that is just very wild.
I heard a sigh from the audience.
Yeah, it's oh my god! Like it goes to some dark, strange places.
Widow Blue.
Widow Blue.
Widow. Okay.
Widow Blue, also known as Joe. What's the title? Sex Psycho. That's it. Yeah, Sex Psycho, Widow Blue. That one is just deranged. That one makes you feel like, okay, like I need 2 days to not watch any movies because I have to process what I just saw. But it's just like a straightforward soap opera slasher that just goes to some very, very dark places.
And directed by a guy named Walt Davis, who Sebastian really loves the other
love
one.
Love Walt Davis.
Yeah. Yeah.
What's the other one?
Evil Come, Evil Go.
Evil Come, Evil
yes.
Go.
Yes, another great Vinegar Syndrome disc.
Excellent.
Evil Come, Evil Go.
Yeah. Oh, and like Alicia mentioned The Haunted Pussy, the Doris Wisher movie. That is just one of the best like adult, in my opinion, because it's Doris Wisher doing her Doris Wisher thing, which is totally surreal and completely removed from reality, like totally. But it's a horror movie. So we were talking about she only made A Night to Dismember, but she made another horror movie, even though she refuses to say, like she was like, I never made an adult movie. Like I never did that, but she did.
To her death said she never made adult movies.
But she did, and The Haunted Pussy is really like a fantastic addition to Doris's filmography.
Yeah.
Any other gems that we're missing, just to make sure we don't skip over anything?
Well, I mean, Suburbia is fucking amazing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so it's Suburbia and Rock and Roll High School are two movies that we got as part of a theatrical deal with Shout Factory, and it opened up a whole floodgate of really awesome hits for us and things that have been, for years as a programmer, hard to book. And now for those to be suddenly easy to book is like a joy for us both on the exhibition and distribution sides.
I assume there's still labs closing and I'm sure there's still movies being lost in the shuffle. Is this still a massive danger? Are there still titles that you know of that could be lost in terms of if they're not restored properly, will never make it to us? Is that still something that we should be concerned about?
Oh yeah, I would say yeah. I'd say that's
way to
the
bring
case.
Me down, man.
Yeah,
I think most of the labs by now have closed that are going to close. I think there are still some that are open that are getting business and that are actually thriving. Mm. But yeah, I mean, I think there are still some that are in danger of being lost forever.
Yeah, I mean, and also like you owe a lot of preservation to people who collect these movies and find them. It's not just archives, it's individuals. And like we have Phil Blankenship in the house tonight, and Phil is probably like the world's foremost authority on prints, period, and where they are in lost movies. And it's because of his like superheroic efforts that we get information, you know? I mean, it's because of people like that with who like calmly and quietly in the background are just doing this amazing work that like, you know, like you got to give it up for Phil. It's like it's incredible what he does. I mean, really. You know, it's all over the world, but it's because of people like Phil that are finding these movies and enabling us to, you know, help preserve them.
What's the book? The Thousand Cuts.
Yeah.
I've already forgotten the title. Sorry, Phil. What's the title? Okay.
Nailed it.
It is right. A Thousand Cuts.
That I can throw to you. But no, I mean, it's interesting. It seems like the secret history of what some of the behavior being illegal, and yet it's without that behavior and without people saving these prints, we would be the ones losing. We, you know, cinema would be the victim of this ultimately. So it's kind of, it's a remarkable story. It's some of the characters who are portrayed in that. I think it's really worth your time if you can seek it out.
And also tomorrow night's event, The Real One Party, is very much in the spirit of all that print collecting. Mm. For example, we'll be talking about the Magna Carta of print collecting, Big Reel magazine, and its influence on just collecting in general, and how all these collections that still survive basically thrived on the lifeblood of this one publication, which is essentially a gray market trading floor for prints before the internet. Mm. And we'll be talking about stuff like that tomorrow night and showing the fruits of the labor of all the collectors.
While you guys are here, you might not get this chance again. So if there's any questions, I guess we could run out and give you the mic. I'm happy to take it up. Oh, you have two mics.
Oh, cool. Excellent. Any questions?
Yes, there's one right there.
Yeah, right there.
Hello?
Hi.
I'm curious how, question for the AGFA team, how important is it for you to be able to, when you're restoring these films, how important is it for you to be able to find the actual filmmaker and speak to them about their work? Because you've talked about getting in touch with the woman who directed Limbo. And I would assume that's an important part of the process, but I'd also assume for some of these really small films, you may not be able to find anyone connected with it.
Oh yeah, there's a few of those.
I mean, I'd say it's really important. It's either one of two things. One, they're no longer with us, unfortunately, because a lot of the movies are older, you know, so they're not around. But two, it's like usually with movies that are really obscure and had small releases, the director usually owns the rights or the producer. So that's the person you have to find in order to find out, like, can we play this movie? Can we put it out? So it's pretty important, I think. In terms of telling the story is also important, especially if you are going to release a Blu-ray, you know, to get them involved and get them talking about the movie. Yeah.
Other questions?
Everybody's quiet because we already talked about The Astrologer.
I shouldn't have led with that. That was my bet.
Yeah, right there.
Do you have any, like, stories about strange places that prints were being stored? You know, I've heard stories about, like, prints being stored in a barn or in caves and stuff like that.
Yeah. I can just tell you the strangest print buy that I ever went on. And if more than one person in this room probably went to the same place, and you know what I'm going to say. It's the Texas Chainsaw Massacre house, basically, in Orange County, where this dude who worked for Regal, who was a projectionist, had several hundred prints in a storage in a barn in his property. And when he brought people onto the property to look at them all for sale, he lined them up in the sun, like just the reels themselves, reels on cores, or just reels without the cores, kind of just slowly unspooling themselves in the baking sun on this like total Texas Chainsaw Massacre house property. And I don't know, you brave it because it's worth the effort. I also bought that print of the Emerson, Lake and Palmer concert film from some Russian mobster guy in the valley in an apartment parking lot.
Everybody just like went crazy. What? You have an Emerson, Lake and Palmer print? Ah!
Yeah.
Like Sebastian and I took some road trips to some cool places to find prints. Yeah. I mean, you know, we went to New Mexico once and that was pretty weird. We got stuck talking to an older gentleman who he had like this, like he was really old. He was like 80 years old and he had like one of those punk studded metal belts on. And Vans. Yeah. And he just sat with us the entire time we were going through this house, like looking at their materials. And he wouldn't leave us alone. If we would like walk upstairs, he'd go, "Joe, Sebastian, where are you? Get back down here." So he could tell us more stories about the good old days. And we had to kind of like put up with it because we wanted to buy his films. But it was a long day. So you kind of meet all kinds and you just kind of, you know, you just roll with it.
He just described your average pot deal circa 96.
Any more questions from the audience?
Yeah, right there.
He's coming for you.
Well, this isn't a question, but I wanted to point out, in case you guys weren't aware, that Don't Panic is actually on US DVD. I think it's really out of print now, but it came out on BCI in a 8-pack called
Crypt of Terror.
Yeah. And that's got Cemetery of Terror too.
Everybody should
watching,
go and buy that.
Set. Yeah.
I agree. It's great. There are like 7 other Mexican horror films from the Galinda family. It's great.
Doesn't that have a skeleton with a sombrero on the cover or something like that? Something ridiculous?
Yep.
Oh my God.
At the back, right?
Yeah, right behind you.
You brought up the fact that there are some people who own movies to which you have materials on that, for whatever reason, don't want them in circulation. What are some of the most bizarre instances of intransigence you've come across from producers or rights holders regarding films that you wanted to help bring back to market?
I got a good stand.
Go for it.
I want to make sure, like, did you want to? Okay. I don't want to take over this conversation, but so I won't, I'm not going to say any names. But once for a Terror Tuesday at the Alamo Drafthouse in Austin, Terror Tuesday is our weekly horror series that we do. We played a movie that we had in the archive. And we didn't know who. We always do due diligence, obviously. Like, we look it up and try to find who it is, and we couldn't find it, so we ran the print. And then we heard back from someone about a week later that was like, you ran my movie. It's going to be $3,000, like, off the top just to pay me, and so we're going to have to work out a deal so that, to make sure that you have to make this up to me. And so I got on the phone with this guy, and I was like, well, we can't pay you $3,000, obviously. We usually pay, like, $300 or whatever. We'll do that. And he was like, no, you got to make it up to me. And so it kept going and going, and he's like, finally, here's what I want to do, okay? We're going to set up a new screening of this movie in your town. You're going to do another Terror Tuesday. You're going to play the movie, but I'm going to get my band to come down to Austin and play. And it's me on bass. It's Rob Zombie on vocals. It's the drummer from Slayer on drums, and that's it. And we're going to come down, and we're going to play a show. It's my close friend Rob Zombie, and we're going to make this happen. We're going to have women walking around in bikinis with TVs, and on the TV is going to be the trailer for the movie playing in the lobby. So before they go in, they know what they're going to see. And it was like, clearly this person is like a maniac and has like lost their mind. But that was, it's such a weird, surreal experience to be talking on the phone and someone is dead serious and probably doesn't even know Rob Zombie, to be honest. Stuff like that happens. It just happens, you know, and you gotta roll with it and be like, yes, sir, that sounds like a great idea. Like, that's, set it up. Call me next week.
So did you do the screening?
Hell no, we did not do the screening. I deleted his number from my phone and went about my business. And we
just I wanted to see who would show up. If not Rob Zombie, who does he bring?
Oh, God. Any others? Well, you have the whole brain trust here.
Well, I have one while they think of questions. So Ulrich and I probably spent a good half an hour on the show a few weeks ago talking about Tammy and the T-Rex. Do we have any Tammy and the T-Rex updates?
Soon. It'll be available soon.
It did place in Apocalypse too, right?
It did place in Apocalypse in Chicago. It's got a few more festival appearances and then it'll be out in the world. And trust me, people will be excited.
I can't wait.
Can you explain, though, for people who here don't know what we're talking about or at home who might have seen Tammy and T-Rex but not seen what we saw, the version we saw, which to me, I can't even imagine seeing the other version.
Because what I saw in USA was not what you showed us.
No. Okay, so I guess we'll just unravel the story of Tammy for everybody because it really took a village to bring this together. Mm. So one of the people who works in the video department at Alamo Drafthouse, Zane, he is the spirit animal of Tammy because he was the one who found it and in like a video call to a bunch of us at the company was like, have you all seen Tammy and the T-Rex? And then it just proceeded to talk about it a lot and get very excited. So then Joe, who programs Alamo's Video Vortex residency, programs Tammy, and it instantly becomes the biggest Video Vortex hit in the residency's history. I put it up in an event here in LA called the 5 Minutes Game. It like wins very enthusiastically. The label who's putting it out, one of their folks was at the screen, the 5 Minutes Game, and he was like, well, we have to put that out on Blu-ray. And so a year later from that, here we are. It's been restored.
Yeah, and so to answer your question, I mean, previously you only knew what you saw on cable or the VHS version, which was a PG-13 kind of high school melodrama involving someone turning into a mechanical dinosaur. It's like, you know, usual stuff. But the version that's going to be out there is an R-rated cut with gore added to it, which changes the movie completely and makes it a totally new experience.
Yeah.
There was a lot of eviscerations. And Jean-Carl Buechler did all the effects.
He did? I didn't even know that. I didn't realize that. Ah,
it is
on too soon.
Yeah. It is Denise Richards and Paul Walker in a post-Jurassic Park rom-com with a mechanical dinosaur in it. His brain is planted into the mechanical dinosaur.
And after we saw it, literally, we're walking back to the parking lot and I looked to Ulrich and I was like, I started processing and I was like, that had like a huge chunk of the same cast as Mannequin 2. Don't ask me why I remember the cast from Mannequin 2, but we're walking back to the car and I'm like, hold on. No, that had like 7 of the same actors from Mannequin 2. And I start Googling on my phone, same director as Mannequin 2.
And as Mac and Me.
Ice Pirates. The list goes on.
Right, it goes on.
It's also quite a touching movie. There's a really sad scene with Atrana. He's trying to call on a payphone and his little arms can't reach the dollar. And it's just like,
but he still checks the quarter slot.
Yeah.
And a very sexy ending. So, you said it as if like the gore's added, but I have to assume that the director's vision, the movie that he made, is this gory, weird teen film. And then the movie that got delivered to the world was this very neutered thing. So this is where the exciting part of, I think, what you guys do, the exciting part of what we get to do when we get to discover things that excite us is, like, this is the movie. This is the movie. The movie you've seen before was not the movie. It was the movie that was forced into existence by censors and networks. But the actual movie that was intended is a gory, strange romp, I assume, right?
Yeah, a Peter Jackson-level gore comedy.
Yeah, no, it was crazy.
Which was then the only time it had a release, which was on tape, was a kind of way cut back PG-13 version of it, presumably to sell to kids. But there's nothing in the movie that appeals to kids, and all the jokes would go over their head.
Well, because it's quite raunchy. Forget about the gore. It's actually quite a raunchy film, so I don't think it would succeed on that level either. But I never saw it on cable, so I don't know what you were seeing.
But I had seen it, and you're right. It doesn't exactly resonate with kids because it didn't become my never-ending story exactly. I was just kind of like, yeah, I saw that, I think. And then it was gone. So, yeah.
But I like the way she writes.
Yeah.
You got to watch that one for that.
You got to watch it.
Yeah. I mean, just from a pure marketing perspective, it's a great thing to have a movie that has this potential cult appeal that can appeal to like a 50-50 male-female audience. Things like Birdemic don't necessarily do that, but this kind of cuts across. And it has movie stars, which is always good. Mm-hmm. Yes, you will be hearing more about Tammy in the future. Trust me.
Worth it. Well worth it. Any last questions?
Well, thank you guys so much for joining us tonight. This has been awesome. And thank you for having us here and for bringing Don't Panic to the screen.
I mean, thank you. Thank you, everyone in this room. We're so grateful to be here with you. Yeah. We're so appreciative.
And what an age where we can bust down the barriers and have such wonderful and wild genre and exploitation movies happen in real film institutions. You're in one of the most hallowed film institutions on the planet watching Don't Panic.
I think Billy Wilder would have dug that film. I just think it would have hit that ticklish spot on him, you know? I think we did him proud. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you all. Thank you.